screenwriter Joe Gillis is in bad shape. He's out of money and on the run from creditors. He stumbles into the home of silent movie star Norma Desmond, who takes a liking to Joe and hires him for odd jobs. But Norma becomes obsessed with Joe, who starts to see her for who she really is. A washed-up, selfish, psychotic, who will destroy anybody who dares remind her of what she's lost. How dangerous is fame? How much more dangerous is losing it? Find out in the 1950 film noir classic, Sunset Boulevard. I'm Connor Izagirre.
I'm Colton Jenkins.
And this is Filmgasm. Welcome to the Filmgasm podcast. After Colton and I had such a blast doing the Foodgasm miniseries, we thought it would be fun to do the same with other mediums of art, starting with film itself. Welcome to Reelgasm, R-E-E-L-gasm, where we're tackling 10 films about filmmaking, from screenwriting to acting to directing and everything in between. We're starting this one with one of the original films to tackle the hypocrisy and bizarre nature of Hollywood, Sunset Boulevard. Yeah, I understand Filmgasm would have been the perfect name for this little miniseries, but that would be very fucking confusing for those at home, wouldn't you say?
Yes. Filmgasm.
Yeah, that's getting a little too Beetlejuicy up in here. So Reelgasm is what we settled on, you know, film reel, you get it. So this was your first time with Sunset Boulevard and Billy Wilder in general, and you did quite a lot of work for this.
I did. For these like deep dives into other mediums of art, I kind of wanted to branch out and not just experience those, you know, types of art in just movies. So I wanted to branch out and take on smaller kind of like personal projects. And for Reelgasm, I wanted to watch movies that are somewhat adjacent to the movie that we are discussing. And I know that that's literally just the podcast, but I wanted to watch more movies. So I watched a lot of Wilder's works. I watched Some Like It Hot, The Apartment, and The Lost Weekend, and now this. And I can agree that Sunset Boulevard is his masterpiece. If I had to rank them, I think I'd go from like best to worst. I'd do Sunset Boulevard, Some Like It Hot, The Apartment, and The Lost Weekend.
Yeah. I'd probably swap Some Like It Hot in The Apartment.
Really?
But yes. Billy Wilder was ahead of his time in terms of character development, in terms of social construct in his films. Like, he was talking about things that no one else was talking about. I mean, you know, in 1945, he tackled alcoholism and suicidal tendencies with The Lost Weekend. People were not talking about that.
No, that's actually... The Lost Weekend is the first... I wanted to watch him in release order, but I think I might have watched... Because Sunset Boulevard came out before The Apartment, I think. Yeah, so I watched The Apartment and Sunset Boulevard in reverse order. But I watched The Lost Weekend first, and I was so surprised that this early on, someone was discussing alcoholism and suicide. That's like a topic that not a lot of people are even talking about today in film, but to see it in a like a black and white, you know, like Hollywood classic, that was crazy. And in all the movies, at least once someone makes a joke about killing themselves, which again is ahead of their time. Like, the younger generation jokes about suicide all the time, and to see it in spades in these movies was honestly mind-blowing. I haven't watched a whole lot of black and white film before these also. I think the only ones I've seen, White Christmas, is that black and white? I think it is. No? What's that? There's a Christmas movie, I think, that's black and white that I watched. It's a Wonderful Life? I don't know. I watched that, Pleasantville. I know that doesn't really count. And then I watched these. I kind of tried to stay clear of them, but I need to open my eyes more because these were truly fantastic.
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of fluffy stupid, ridiculous black and white films, because a lot of films of this era were just cranked out on a conveyor belt to meet deadlines. But there were also artists who wanted to make their mark, who had something to say. And Billy Wilder's one of these guys. The Apartment, I think, is one of the greatest romantic comedies ever made. It's a real relationship that you get to see from start to finish, build on a foundation of mutual respect. And you did not see that a lot in the, like, in the 40s, 50s, leading up to the 60s. And
it's usually like, my wife, she's, you know, she's like really, really, you know, hard, you know, hardcore, like, feminist. So I try to watch these movies with her, and she really enjoyed The Apartment because it's not just a creepy guy hitting on a woman who's like twirling her hair and be like, oh, whatever you say, man. Like, they really like enjoyed each other's company. And also just the premise of like someone letting their boss or other coworkers use their apartment for sex, that could come out today.
Yeah. Such a fucked up situation. But you know, when you're at the bottom of the totem pole at Business Incorporated or whatever the hell, and your boss says, I need your apartment, you give him the keys. That's how it, you know, that's how the totem pole worked.
Yeah. I also wonder, do you think he like changed his sheets?
I hope so. Jesus. I don't want to sleep in my boss's fuck sweat. I hope to God he changed the sheets.
Like, do you think it's like one of his rules? Like, okay, yeah, you can have my apartment, but when you're done, you gotta like do laundry. Like, you gotta like change the sheets. I'll always have a fresh set. Just fucking change it, please.
I doubt it. I don't think Fred McMurray gave a shit about Jack Lemmon's feelings one time. And then Some Like It Hot, you know, features some early like transgender characters.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not really played for I mean, it's played for laughs sometimes, but overall it's treated pretty seriously.
Yeah, even there's a line in Some Like It Hot, and it's after Daphne gets pinched in the elevator, and she's like, oh, I just got grabbed. And Joe is like, well, that's how the other half lives. Deal with it. And I was like, damn, that's
I that love the
at this time. Yeah.
There's that. I love the final line where Jack Lemmon's character is like trying to convince the guy like to not marry him. And eventually he's like, okay, look, I'm a man. And the guy's like, well, nobody's perfect.
Yeah. It's like, okay, sure. I'll still marry. Yeah. Even when he's convincing him, he's like, you can't marry him. You're a guy. And he's like, okay. And like, progressive.
Right. Yeah. And then you got Sunset Boulevard, which shined a spotlight on like negative aspects of fame and the stars of Hollywood who were cast aside in favor of the next generation. Another thing you didn't really think about back then. Yeah.
Not only that, but like, you know, it shined a light on obsession, toxic relationships. Yeah. Crazy stuff.
Yeah. It's pretty serious. It doesn't feel, you know, manufactured. It feels very much like this came from a real place.
It really does, yeah.
The best kind of, you know, black and white films, if you know, I really just see it as film now. Like, I don't really have a designation.
Mm.
But, like, the best kind of films that last are the ones that could be made today. The ones that have a story that's still relevant and feature performances that still feel genuine.
Yeah. Actually, I have seen another black and white film. I don't know if it counts. I'm going to say The Lighthouse. It was filmed the same way that these movies were filmed, but I don't think that counts. It's still modern. But
I would not count it, but you know, you go ahead. Well, cool. I'm glad we could talk a little bit about Billy Wilder. We'll talk a little bit more about him as we go along. My question to you. So this movie deals very much with fame and the negative consequences of fame. You know, how does it, you know, who are you when you lose it? And I just thought a good question to kind of start things off. Would you ever want to be famous?
Yes, I would. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people have that desire, especially in today's world of, you know, internet fame and stuff like that. It's never been easier, but, I would, but as long as I still had my friends and stuff, I know I might be an asshole for saying this, but the saying money doesn't buy you happiness, I 100% believe that is complete bullshit. It 100% does. The only people saying that are rich people. I'm sorry, but money might not be able to buy you happiness, but to quote a country song, it can buy you a boat. It can buy you a truck to pull it. It can buy, literally all my problems will be solved if I was rich. I'm sorry, but that's just the way it is. But fame, I would.
You can be rich without being famous, though.
That is fair. Fame, I think I'd enjoy it, but to an extent. It would be cool for a little bit, and then it might be a little annoying. I mean, I think the best person to look at for this, as much of an asshole as he is on set, is Tobey Maguire. You know, he's been harassed by paparazzi for years. So it would be frustrating, but I mean, everyone, I think, has that innate desire to be famous, be known. What about you?
I don't really? Have that. I want my work to be known. I want to be respected for what I do. But do I want to be hounded by people all the time? Do I want my privacy to disappear? Do I want to constantly be in the spotlight? Do I want the narrative of my life to be manufactured by people I can't control? No. No, I don't.
That's fair. I think actually that's a better way to say what I meant. Yeah. Having my work known would be very nice. I don't think being in the spotlight 24/7 would be very,
Like, you know, if somebody recognizes my name and they're like, oh my God, I love your work, then that'd be awesome. But if I've got like, you know, I have to sneak out the back of a restaurant because the paparazzi are out front ready to snap a picture of me. Like, no, I can't imagine living like that.
No. Yeah.
And also, like, the complete shell shock when, like, if you lose that, if people don't think you're worth taking pictures of anymore, if you, like, aren't famous anymore, how do you cope with that? How do you cope with the idea that, like, to most of the world, you no longer matter?
Yeah.
That's got to fuck you up psychologically.
Yeah. That's true, yeah. I think I'll agree with that. I'll take your answer, yeah. I want my work to be known, but I don't really want to be in the spotlight all the time. Yeah.
I think writers are the only kind of like creative that really get to do that, where they can kind of work not in total anonymity, but in close enough anonymity where they can go have a coffee without dealing with people.
Yeah. It's interesting too, because I feel like now there's different kinds of celebrity. Like, there are internet celebrities who I feel like can go out and have, you know, like, privacy, live their own lives. But thousands of people know who they are and will recognize them. Yeah. Same. I mean, we do a podcast. There's, like, so many people who have, like, famous podcasts. They can go out and do their own thing. But I still think, like you said, it's their work that's more known than just them.
Yeah. And it is, like, celebrity has never been more fickle. It's this weird idea that, like, you don't have to be good at anything to be famous anymore. You don't have to have a skill. All you got to be is, like, you know, hot or easy for the most part.
Yeah.
And you can be, you know, an icon to people. It's weird. Like, there's people, like, on, you know, Instagram who are, like, you know, really hot and, like, I follow them. But, like, I don't look up to them. I don't see them as, like, somebody to admire.
Mm-hmm.
They do what they do, and that's fine. You know, but I would never say to, like, you know, I don't have, like, any, you know, children or niece or nephews, but I have cousins who I would say, like, hey, maybe find a different role model.
Yeah.
You should never want to aspire to be famous. You should want to aspire to be good at something. And the fame will come if it does, but you should want to just be good at something.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. My question to you, is not necessarily completely about the movie. It's more about, Billy Wilder kind of as like a whole. So this movie, like you said, before this time, movies were cranked out like a factory, and then Billy Wilder happened and a lot more directors followed suit, and you know, a lot of really good movies came out in, like, you know, the 80s, 90s, early 2000s. I feel like now we are kind of entering another era of movies just being cranked out with Marvel and everything. Do you think there is ever a chance that we can get back to another, I guess, quote unquote, golden era of film like the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s?
That's a very good question. Every generation has their storytellers. They've, you know, we've got, you know, there's Alfred Hitchcock, Steven Spielberg, Billy Wilder, Frank Capra, Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, like Quentin Tarantino and Paul Thomas Anderson in the 90s. Like every generation has the greats, the people who are going to change film for that generation and inspire countless people to follow. We still have those guys. We still have, you know, Greta Gerwig, Noah Baumbach, Robert Eggers, Jordan Peele, Ari Aster. Like, they're still here. And they're still making things, and they're still inspiring people. And they are regrettably being overshadowed by monumental blockbusters that are really just not making money anymore. But people are starting to recognize that. They're starting to realize that they want substance over style again. And I think that we are possibly on the cusp of seeing something like that, seeing a resurgence of creativity and originality in Hollywood, which would be astonishing and be just fantastic. I can't wait to see who these guys inspire in the next generation and what those guys are going to make. Those are the people you got to watch out for. Those are the careers you want to follow. You know, I can't tell you who directed the most recent, I don't know. I think it was Nia DaCosta who directed the Marvels, but really it was, you know, Disney put any director who wanted the job on that set and told them what to do. I don't really think that's her movie. Whereas like the Candyman remake, that was her, and that had a vision, and that was really cool. So like, you gotta really just look into like indie film and these singular vision directors who are doing stuff that they want to do and are making films that are going to resonate with people, and just keep looking at what they got. Keep, you know, look at who they're following. Look at the people who they say are going to be, you know, the next big people, and just stay in that bubble.
Yeah. I really like that answer, actually. Do you think then like they're not going to, cause they make too much money, but do you think Disney should stop or at least take a break? Truly, do you think that they should?
Yes. So I think if we had, let's say, a year-long break from films that have like $200 or $200 million plus budgets, and we just had original film for a while, I think we could get back on track pretty quickly. And, you know, I'm not, you know, you can have a blockbuster that's awesome. There's been some really good ones lately. Well, okay, not lately, but like in the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. And if a film is made with care and love, it doesn't matter how much money went into it. It doesn't matter who's behind the camera. You can always tell. You can always tell, you know, the fucking manufactured gas station hot dog or the, you know, barbecue made from some dude with his like recipe he got from his granddad. You can always tell the difference. And I think that the studios since the dawn of Hollywood have dictated how film is manufactured, and they've always gotten in their own way and bet heavily on, you know, spectacle. And sometimes it pays off, but not at the moment. At the moment, there's a rut happening. There's a string of failures happening.
Yep.
And somebody has to take accountability for that and figure out what went wrong, and nobody's going to. The failures are going to keep going because no one in power realizes there's a problem.
So, do you think that they don't realize there's a problem, or do you think it's they don't care?
I think they really honestly don't see it. I think they've deluded themselves to the point where they don't think they're the problem, and they're just going to keep throwing more money at it.
They just see the numbers.
You can't, in that kind of position, you can't admit that you fucked up, or else there's going to be another suit that's going to replace you. And the cycle repeats. That's how we end up with lukewarm Indiana Jones movies that tank at the box office and DC projects that nobody goes to see.
Yep. But sometimes, don't you crave a mass-produced gas station hot dog?
All the time. I've seen all of this shit this year. I've gone to see all of it. Yeah. I've often referred to myself as Hollywood's bitch. I stand by that. I see all of it. I don't necessarily like all of it, but I give everything a chance before I bitch at it.
Yeah. I saw this video essay a while ago. It was titled, What Happened? Or, The Death of the Mid-Budget Movie.
Mm.
Every movie nowadays has, multi-million dollar budget. It's insane. Billion dollar. They need to come back to,
The thing about the mid-budget film, streaming services killed that.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants to go see a movie like that because they can just watch it at home.
Yeah.
And that mentality is now now affecting the blockbuster, because people are now saying I don't have to go see that Marvel movie. I can wait 3 weeks and watch it on Disney Plus. Nobody cares anymore because everything's so convenient. That's why a lot of these blockbusters are failing, because nobody believes in the film and nobody wants to spend, $20 to go see it.
It's just content that they can watch at home when it comes out.
Film has become content. It's become something to consume as opposed to something to enjoy.
Yeah. Regardless how you feel about it, the Five Nights at Freddy's movie that came out to theaters and Peacock, I watched it at home.
Me too.
Which means that I don't know how streaming works, but they didn't get money from me watching it. They got money from the service buying it.
I have no idea how the streaming numbers work, how streaming service measures success in a product, because they won't tell us. They're keeping that shit very close to the chest, which is shady as hell.
Mm.
But I don't know. It was a success. It made a fuck ton of money at the box office. So Five Nights at Freddy's worked. It's one of the highest grossing films of the year, which I never would have thought.
And it's also Disney needs to stop. But they wouldn't need to stop if they just gave a shit about what they were producing. Disney's Renaissance, those movies are incredible. Yeah. And why don't they come out with more of those? It's because they have to come out with a new Disney movie every year.
They don't have to.
They don't have to. If they took a break, for a year, and they say they took that year to make one movie. Or, I know that they're probably making new movies way in advance. But you know what I mean? If they took a break, focus on one great movie, they could come back in the people's graces, not just, money-wise, numbers-wise. Because Wish is coming out. I don't know if you've seen it online, but that movie is getting, torn into. Because it's just, the song for the villain, again, just sounds like more of, Lin-Manuel Miranda's, rap pop shit that Disney has been making since Frozen.
Well, the thing with Disney, they're so damn powerful and they have so much money that they're just kind of shrugging off these failures. They haven't really lost anything.
Mm-hmm.
Every movie they've released this year has tanked, except for Guardians of the Galaxy 3, because that was James Gunn, a director with a vision, who was doing his own thing. Everything else, Elemental eventually made its money back. Indiana Jones was a huge flop. Ant-Man 3 flopped. The Marvels flopped. It's the Haunted Mansion flopped. Everything they did this year flopped.
One of the biggest fixes they could have done for Haunted Mansion is just release it in October. That's all they had. Why did they release it in July?
I don't know. They did the same thing to Hocus Pocus back in 93.
Did they really?
Yeah, that came out in May, I think.
What? That's like a Halloween movie.
It didn't do well at the box office, and guess what? It premiered on the Disney Channel in October, and people fucking loved it.
Oh shit! Okay.
Yep.
Well, damn. So,
like I said, the suits just keep getting in their own way. They always have. They never let creatives do their thing. They always think they're the smartest person in the room because they paid for the room. It's an ongoing problem. I don't see it getting better. And that's all I got to say about that.
Did you like Top Gun Maverick?
I did actually. I thought it was great.
So there's I watch another video, and this guy was saying that the reason that Top Gun Maverick felt different than most modern movies is because it follows the same formula as the first Top Gun in movies of that time, where there's not a deeper message. It's literally just hero looks cool on a bike, stands in front of American flag, and saves the day. So with that being said, you know, it seems like you say that we need to like focus on the smaller people. But if, do you think like if Hollywood just focused on, I guess not Hollywood, if people focused more on independent movies with, you know, every movie has something to say, do you think that that can get tiring after a while?
Yeah, I do. And then we figure out, you know, then maybe we have a blockbuster renaissance. These things come in waves, and film's always evolving into what the people want to see at the time. And right now, they don't want blockbusters. They made that very clear.
Yeah.
So if we start looking at, you know, a surge in independent film, eventually maybe that'll drop off and then we'll want something else. You know, that's why we ended up with the fucking penguin craze in 2006, because people wanted penguins. So we got a bunch of penguin movies.
Yeah, that is true. And it's interesting because like Marvel movies, I don't know numbers, but just me personally, I was huge into like the Marvel movies, and now I just don't care anymore. So like you, like they do come in waves.
Yeah. Well, and also Marvel shot themselves in the foot with the TV shows. That's what fucked everything up.
Yeah.
We talked about that on a recent episode on the Marvels. We went into why Marvel has dropped the ball so many times. But yeah, you know, this was happening in the 50s too. Yeah. A lot of films were being used, like especially like John Wayne Westerns were starting to, you know, people didn't want just American hero versus the obvious communist insert. They wanted something a little better. So, you know, that had to evolve too. And, you know, these guys like Howard Hawks and Billy Wilder and William Wyler and all these guys, they were the people that like Martin Scorsese and Steven Spielberg were watching when they were kids. So they were getting their own ideas for how to make a film. And then when they grew up, they made film their own way and changed the game in that direction. So it's film is always just constantly rolling along, evolving as needed, and influencing the right people. That's how you keep going. That's how it keeps going. Yeah. Because there's been slumps in the box office you wouldn't fucking believe in the past that could have bankrupted the whole damn industry. But you had people still believing in film who were powerful enough to make sure that the industry stayed alive. Yeah. And here we are.
Yeah, it is a very strange. It's like, you know what? It's the Wild West. You never know what's going to happen. Yeah, it's crazy, man.
There's a line in the movie Mank, which, spoiler alert, is going to be one of the ones we're going to talk about in a few weeks. But Louis B. Mayer, one of the sleaziest pieces of shit in Hollywood history, is explaining what the movie industry is to Herman Mankiewicz as he's giving him a tour of MGM. And he says something along the lines, and I'm paraphrasing here, but that the film industry is the only industry that sells an idea. There's no product to the customer. Mm-hmm. You don't walk away with anything. You are selling a memory. And it's their job to make that memory last forever.
That's actually very... Yeah, that is
interesting.
Pretty
fucking poignant from the guy who...
That's poignant. Damn. Damn, yeah, that's true. Holy shit.
And I am, you know, I'm in love with that feeling. I'm in love with the feeling of finding that memory. And I am searching for it all the time. That's why I watch all of this shit, because I never know if I'm going to find a movie that's going to stay with me for the rest of my life, because it was an amazing motion picture.
Well, maybe someday soon you'll find a movie that does just that.
You never know. Yeah. So, yeah, that was a hell of an introduction conversation, man. That was good. That was fun. Fuck. Okay. Let's talk Sunset. Sunset Boulevard was inspired by the famous street of the same name in Los Angeles, Hollywood's first ever film studio, Nestor Film Company, began on that street in 1911. That's why it's arguably the most famous street in LA, next to Rodeo Drive and Mulholland Drive. It used to be the street where the film workers lived. So that's where all the, you know, cinematographers and the editors and the set designers, that's where they lived. But after profits from films started to rise to insane heights alongside salaries for actors and directors, they started building bigger, more luxurious homes on Sunset. The little people were forced out, and it became the place where the big, you know, big ballers lived.
Yep. Bill Murray has a mansion there. It's great. I'm scared. It's Zombieland.
Yeah. Well, Sunset, a lot of, you know, that's where a lot of people, a lot of famous people live. Sunset's become kind of a mecca for film buffs to just like leer at famous people's houses, which I always find creepy. I've been to LA. Yeah. I didn't need to go look at famous people's houses.
Yeah, no.
Nope. I did, however, I did see Jack Nicholson's house, and I did get kind of chills from that.
Why? Does it look like the Overlook Hotel? Like, what?
No, it's just like Jack Nicholson's in there. I had a moment of like, I'm 100 feet from Jack Nicholson.
Like he could be taking a shit and you don't even know. Like,
he could be. But that's Jack Nicholson taking a shit. And he probably does it better than anybody. So the film's director, Billy Wilder, was a Los Angeles resident in the late 40s, and he was fascinated by the culture of Hollywood. He looked around at the giant mansions on Sunset. He knew a lot of silent movie stars still occupied those houses, despite not having been involved in the movie business for decades, largely forced out for the new wave of talent. That's how it worked back then. Once you hit like 40, 50 years old, especially if you were a woman, you retired forcibly, and they got the new hot thing to replace you. That happened a lot. Billy Wilder wondered what these people were doing with their time now that the industry had moved on without them. That's where the seeds for Sunset Boulevard came from. Just what are these people doing? They're not dead. They're still here, but what are they doing? And Wilder teamed with screenwriter Charles Brackett and began working on a script inspired by Wilder's thoughts on silent movie stars and their new normal. They brought on D.M. Marshman Jr. to assist after they read a critique of their film, The Emperor Waltz, that he had written. They liked it and thought, this guy knows what he's talking about. Let's bring him in to help us work on this script. Which is pretty cool.
That is pretty
cool. I've reviewed a fuck ton of movies. I hope one day a director sees one of mine and thinks, you get it, kid. You want to help me write this? They only submitted a few pages at a time so they could keep the whole thing fairly secret from Paramount Pictures, who are featured prominently in this movie.
Oh, and shit.
Avoid censorship from the Hays office as much as possible, because this was during the Hays Code era, and there's some sensitive topics in this movie. So they wanted to avoid dealing with them as much as possible. And I guess if you don't give them the whole script, they can't give you a fuck ton of edits.
Oh, damn.
No. In terms of casting, the original picks for the leads were Mae West as Norma Desmond and Marlon Brando as Joe Gillis. That's who Wilder wanted. Yeah, Brando. And this was 50s Brando, so that was he wasn't psycho yet. He was still hot commodity Brando.
He would have actually read his script.
Yeah, this is right before Streetcar Named Desire, so he would have been like, you know, willing to participate. West rejected the offer immediately, taking offense to the idea that she should portray a Hollywood has-been. She's one of the actresses who did transition from silent films to talkies with no problem.
Oh, okay.
She was still considered quite a sex symbol in the 40s. No word on why Brando said no, but he was Brando. He probably didn't have a very valid reason, but didn't care. Then they met Gloria Swanson, whose career was remarkably similar to this character. She started in silent films and had trouble transitioning to talkies. Swanson accepted her time in Hollywood was over, moved to New York to work in radio. Then she moved to television in the mid-40s, did some work on the stage. She wasn't interested in restarting her film career, but the role intrigued her enough. And after finally being convinced to submit a screen test, she won the role. She, ironically, exactly the way Norma Desmond would do it, she was appalled at the idea that she should have to audition for this. She was like, I happen or not. Like, I don't want to audition for this. And they're like, you're so Norma, but we need a screen test.
So was she called, actually, was she like Norma? And like,
yeah, for the not the like super psychotic part, but the staring diva who thought she was, you know, a real artist, darling. You know, yeah, that was pretty much her.
That's funny.
Yeah, pretty crazy. Montgomery Clift was signed on to play Joe Gillis, but he pulled out when he suddenly realized he had already played a character much like this the previous year in The Heiress, which is a fantastic movie with Olivia de Havilland that we did on the podcast a long time ago. Very good movie. Montgomery Clift, a younger guy, not believable as a washed up writer. He still seems more like in this time, like the kind of guy who'd be cutting his teeth on a new script, like just got the Hollywood. So since Wilder had to work with only contract players owned by Paramount, he could only pick actors for this who were owned by Paramount. Back in the day, actors had contracts with certain studios.
Oh.
So like if you wanted to work, like if you were owned by MGM, if your contract was owned by MGM, but you wanted to work on a Universal film, MGM had to like loan you out to Universal for a crazy amount of money or just straight up sell your contract if you were considered, you know, not worth their time or money.
That is interesting. I didn't know that. When did that, do you know when that stopped?
The 60s. Like once independent directors pretty much took control away from the studios, that shit stopped.
Interesting.
No. So he settled on William Holden, who had paused his film career to serve in World War II, and upon his return had been met with great success. So Holden was the real deal. He played a couple of war movies like Stalag 17 and The Bridge on the River Kwai, and he was channeling his real-life war experience into those roles. And he's great in this movie. He plays, Joe is this, like, grizzled old, I could give a shit, my career's over, son of a bitch.
He's like, I don't care, I just want... He's literally, you know what he is? He's today's millennial. He's like, I don't care. I just want to like make enough to live. I don't care what I do.
Yeah. Ahead of his time. Sunset Boulevard was an enormous success, grossing $5 million on a budget of $1.75 million. And for 1950, that was fucking awesome.
Damn, dude.
It was nominated for 11 Oscars at the 23rd Academy Awards.
Holy fuck, man.
It won 3, Best Original Screenplay, Best Art Direction, and Best Original Score. It was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor for William Holden, Best Actress for Gloria Swanson, Best Supporting Actor for Eric von Stroheim, Best Supporting Actress for Nancy Olsen, Best Cinematography, and Best Film Editing. It lost Best Picture to All About Eve, which is another phenomenal fucking movie that I totally, totally get it. I actually bought that today on Blu-ray. I found it cheap, and I was so excited. Sunset Boulevard has an IMDb score of 8.4, Rotten Tomatoes score of 98%, audience score of 95%. Critics' consensus reads, arguably the greatest movie about Hollywood. Billy Wilder's masterpiece, Sunset Boulevard, is a tremendously entertaining combination of noir, black comedy, and character study. The film is streaming free with ads on YouTube and on Paramount Plus. It is often ranked among the greatest films ever made.
Yeah. If I had seen this movie when it came out, I think I would agree. It is a really, it's a very good movie. Like I said, it's the best out of the four that I watched for Billy Wilder. Seriously, like ahead of its time. I know we keep saying that, but really, if you haven't seen it, you need to. Did they remake it in 2016?
No, they never remade this movie. They tried to readapt it as like a Broadway musical a couple times, but I don't think it ever really took.
Okay.
Yeah. You'd have to have some fucking balls.
Yeah.
Sunset Boulevard. There's certain movies like are so perfect and revered by modern filmmakers that no one's going to fucking touch them. And Sunset Boulevard is one of those, I'd say like The Godfather, All About Eve, another one.
Back to the Future.
Back to the Future. God knows they are fucking circling that one like sharks. Thank God Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale have said over our dead bodies.
When they die, they're gonna like the day that they, like they die, you know. So like, hey, just announced.
Well, knowing these guys, there's gonna be some stipulation in the will that like the rights to Back to the Future are gonna go to like their families or locked away in the Universal Vault, something. There, no one's touching Back to the Future.
Fucking hope not.
They better not. I will boycott that set. I will burn some shit down. I will. I'll make sure that movie doesn't happen.
I heard a rumor, it might be true, that they were going to make a fourth one, but like they just couldn't because of Michael J. Fox.
They've been talking about part four since 1990, since part three came out. They were like, where's part four? But yeah, Michael J. Fox's Parkinson's got too severe. He had to retire. And Christopher Lloyd would never do it without Michael J. Fox. So there's no way. And I'm okay with that. It's one of the few perfect trilogies in Hollywood for me. I don't need a fourth Back to the Future.
There kind of is a fourth one. The Telltale.
Yeah, there's that game, which is a pretty good story.
I mean, shit, there's even kind of a third Ghostbusters, if you count the game. It came out as a sequel.
And it's we also got, you know, the Afterlife. Real Ghostbusters, which... I think I'm looking forward to part four, by the way, if we're talking about a blockbuster that I'm looking forward to.
Yeah.
Frozen Empire. I don't like the title, but
I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Sunset's amazing. I have a cheap DVD. I got to get this on Blu-ray.
On VHS. I just recently started collecting VHS tapes. Because I found the like original Star Wars on VHS, and I fucking bought a VHS player, and it's great. I think I told you the Jabba the Hutt scene's not even in it in the original Star Wars.
Nah, that was they added it into the special edition where he was just like a big Irish guy in a fur coat, being like, "Han, my boy, where's my money? why are you turning me down, boy?" Like, it's just so ridiculous. I prefer big slug monster to fuzzy Irish guy. Let's do some categories. Let's talk about our favorite bits of Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
Let's start with performance. So everyone's amazing in this.
Yes.
Curious as to who you picked as your like winner of the movie. Who do you think wins the movie in terms of performance?
Easily Gloria Swanson.
Yeah.
Norma Desmond, that stare that she does with her eyes, she like tilts her head back. Yeah, that was great. The scene when they're watching a movie in her mansion and she grabs his arm, the way she like moves her fingers over his arm, just everything she did, it gave, I don't want to say washed up actress, because I know that's what she is, but I truly felt pity for her, like really. I don't remember where I was watching, I don't remember what I was reading, but it described her as a rose that has wilted, like a wilted rose. It's still beautiful, but like, you know,
broken.
I really felt bad for her. She was wonderful.
Gloria Swanson, yeah, really delivers in this movie as just a fucking nut. A person who has been driven so insane by her own nature of celebrity and talent, thinking she's, you know, like the line, you know, I am big, it's the pictures that got small. Like, that is the most, like, egotistical shit I've ever heard in a movie. Just be like, yeah, I made Paramount. Like, there is no Paramount without me. Like, it's just crazy. And
but is she wrong?
I don't know. I mean, Cecil surely seems to think, you know, this bitch needs to go.
I will explain why I don't think she's wrong in a second when we talk about scenes. There's a scene where I was like, damn, okay. She's not wrong.
Okay. But yeah, I do love how the character is just, the more we learn about her, the more we learn about her, the more time she spends around Joe, the more insane she starts to seem, the more unhinged, until it all culminates in that murder.
I think obviously she's insane, but I don't think she's completely broken. I think she is breaking through the movie.
She's just for really sure
lonely. She's been cast aside, lonely, you know. Yeah.
And Joe's the only one who calls her on, you know, tells her how the world really is, that, you know, you're not famous anymore. Like, you're done. You're washed up. You're has been, you know, there's new broads on the pictures now. And she can't take that. She can't handle that. She can't handle the idea that she's not on top of the world.
Yeah. Do you think he started to care about her towards the end?
No.
Just
he uses everybody in this movie.
He really
it's
does.
It's all about Joe. Joe, as long as Joe gets his, fuck everyone else.
I could construe this as he's the villain of the movie, and Norma is the good guy, the protagonist.
That is certainly an angle to take. I think, yeah, that's cool. I picked William Holden for my
winner.
Because he's the only one in this movie who makes sense. He's a dick and he's manipulative, but he gets how the world works. He understands that no one's going to hand you shit, that you got to take it.
He does. And do you know who he reminded me of? And this might be weird for me to say, but he reminded me of a tame Travis Bickle, because they both have the same outlook on the world.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can totally see that. I think Taxi Driver was very influenced by this movie.
Okay, this is another hot take. Travis Bickle is an asshole. He is not a good guy, but he is sort of a vigilante at the end. He becomes like, he is a good guy. He just is very disconnected. But something tells me, we'll talk about Taxi Driver at a later date.
The thing about Travis, like, all that shit, all of his heroism is in his own head. He doesn't actually do anything.
He doesn't, but I haven't seen it in a long time. He kills an abusive pimp. Doesn't he save, like...
That's what's all, like, in his head at the end.
Oh, he didn't actually do that?
He's imagining all of it, if I remember correctly. It's been a minute since I watched Taxi Driver as well.
Oh, damn.
But I seem to remember it being a moment of, like, yeah, that'd be awesome, but I'm not going to do it.
Okay. Even if that was all in his head, I still think that him and Joe, they feel the same about the world. They are the same person, just at different... Honestly, they're in different time periods. If Joe Gillis existed in 1970s New York, he would become Travis.
Yeah. I like a good downtrodden, quote-unquote, hero who's just been through the ringer and, you know, had his dream job and kind of lost it and is so jaded by the world that he really has nothing left to live for. And that's our hero. That's the guy showing us Hollywood in this movie. You know, the place where, you know, you'll get bitten up and chewed up and spit out if you don't kiss the right ass.
Yep.
And that's this is the glimpse of Hollywood no one had seen before Billy Wilder said, yeah, Hollywood's not all, you know, sunshine, lollipops, and stardust. It's a nightmare to certain people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've gotten more and more peaks behind the curtain since then, but, you know, Billy Wilder's the guy who peaked first.
The sun is setting on old Hollywood.
And I think Eric von Stroheim and Nancy Olsen are great too. Eric von Stroheim's, like, devotion, you know, Max's devotion to Norma is so displaced, but, in, you know, fiercely loyal.
I thought he was going to be kind of like a villain, but I truly think he just still loves her and just cares about her and feels bad. Because I think he blames himself, because, like he said, he was, not only was he her first husband, he is the person that, like, discovered her and turned her into a star.
Well, Eric von Stroheim was an accomplished 20s director.
Yeah.
So I wonder if, you know, he was cast because he had that kind of relationship with some of these stars. You know, I'm sure he discovered a few people.
Yeah.
And then Nancy Olsen as, you know, the typist who keeps telling Joe he's terrible at writing. I love that.
Yeah, that was good.
I didn't like it, but I like this part.
I will say there's a lot of, like, I know it's a sign of the time, but there's a lot of, like, cheating on wives in all of these movies, in all four.
Well, yeah, you know, again, that's the world, man. You know, a lot of Hollywood romances, especially then, was like, you know, you meet your true love and 2 days later you're married. Like, that's not how the world works. You know, nope. Love takes work. Love is, yep. you know, you got to keep that shit alive, and people stray. It happens. And, you know, you can either choose to work on that or you can see that as the ultimate betrayal. That's up to you.
It's also just crazy. Like, Nancy Olsen does really good, and I felt bad for her because, yeah, she like is going to cheat on her husband and leave him for Joe. But fucking when she goes to get Joe and she's like, come with me. Joe's like, why the fuck would I give this mansion up for you? And then she leaves and he's like, damn, I might have made a mistake. Norma, I'm leaving your bitch ass too. What a fucking asshole.
He's in it for Joe. Joe, you know, it's weird, but yeah, his relationship with Norma is so fucking twisted and toxic and just unlike anything I've ever seen in this decade. And yeah, it's, you know, they're both the bad guy here. They're both terrible in their own way. And it's just creating this toxic fume of,
yeah, you
know, of who gives a fuck. That's just bleeding on other people.
I think Norma was using Joe, but I think she didn't care about him. She just wanted him around.
She needed something.
Yeah. I mean, he's the only person that would, he was lying, but he was the only person that would talk to her. Like, actually talk.
He was straight up a replacement for that chimp. That's all he was to her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like Joe had like some embers of care for Norma, bits and pieces here and there. The way that he was defensive about the cigarette case. I was like, okay. And then when he got home, like when he found out that she like slit her wrists, he would have rushed home because he's like, damn, I'm losing my mansion in all this shit. But also he wouldn't have gone home that quick if he didn't somewhat care. So it was just completely toxic, abusive, using each other. But I think they saw a little bit of themselves in each other. You know what I mean? They cared a little bit. Norma more than Joe, but still.
See, the layers of this thing is what keeps this alive. Like, that's why we're still talking about this movie, what, 73 years later? Fucking hell. Okay, let's go music. This is a score by Franz Waxman, who was a very accomplished composer for film. He did a lot of Hitchcock movies, like Rear Window was one of his. Mm-hmm. Rebecca, Stalag 17, one of Holden's films. Bride of Frankenstein, like, yeah, he was good. And this score, he won an Oscar for this score. And it's great. It's very pulse-pounding, very sensitive. Like, it's yeah, a mixture of everything. I love the opening credits of this movie because it does not give you the movie you're about to watch.
No, it's very, like, upbeat and happy.
I felt it was very upbeat and, like, scary. It was almost like, you know, buckle the fuck up. You're not prepared for what you're about to
do. I liked the, I don't know what any of the tracks are called, but it's when he pulls into the mansion for the first time and he's walking around. And when he first sees her in the window, I'm like, oh damn, is this a horror? Like, for a second, I was like, this is going to be a horror movie. So that was a really cool track. And then the only other, I feel bad saying this, but the only memorable track I have is that one, the opening credits. And then the music that's playing when he's looking out of the window and they're burying the monkey. It was just creepy. I don't know.
I liked the bit where he is driving through LA and he gets spotted by the repo guys.
And yeah, that was a good
brief car chase, and the music turns very action-y and very... Waxman did a good job of adapting to the scene at hand. Like, there's no... The score is very malleable. You know, if we need horror, it's here. If we need action, it's here. If we need romance, it's here. Like, he knew what the scene needed.
It's a very, it is a movie soundtrack for a movie about movies.
Yeah, that's it, great. I love that.
The score isn't thematic throughout. It literally is, I feel like, done on purpose. It was done to fit the scene, much like, you know, Hollywood, you know.
Well, a lot of film scores back then, especially, I've talked about this with Austin a lot. A lot of film scores back then were very much just like, hey, we got a Western in the can. Somebody call, you know, Jeff. He'll make something. And they were just, you know, here's a generic Western score, you know, have it done in 2 hours, send it to MGM. So like, the fact that Waxman clearly like watched this and felt, you know, this needs this and this needs that. I like the guys who gave a shit, who actually tried to make something.
Yeah. It's also interesting how, like, as throwaway as it was, the Western soundtrack sound is so prevalent today. Like, it's in Red Dead Redemption. Like, you know,
yeah, it very much is an established tone that every Western, yeah, kind of globally, mm-hmm, has just adopted. As you know, if you hear that music, you can tell it's a Western.
What is that instrument? Is it a flute? A whistle? You know what I'm talking about? You know.
Yeah, the like the good, the bad, and the ugly music.
Yes.
Yeah, Morricone was the godfather of Western themes, and yeah, that was him.
Yeah,
good stuff. Let's do a line. Let's do some dialogue. This movie has some epic dialogue. I just want to shout out real first. First, what a weird thing to hear from a house you just walked into. If you need any help with the coffin, call me.
Yeah. See, that's another thing I realized about Billy Wilder's movies. I don't know a lot about the movies of the time, but if he puts a joke in the movie, there's always like a callback later, especially in Some Like It Hot. Like the fact that they have type O blood, that comes up like 3 times. Or even in Some Like It Hot, when the guy's like, oh, fuck, where are my glasses? And then like literally 2 scenes later, Joe pulls him out of his pocket. It's so good.
Well, I've often thought that, you know, comedy is the hardest thing to write. So yeah. I think, you know, including callbacks and like making sure that, you know, it's a way to keep your audience invested and a way to keep the audience paying attention. And yeah, Wilder just knew how to keep asses in seats. He knew what people like needed to see. And that's something that very few directors knew. Yeah, Wilder, fucking legend.
I also do like the coffin line, because I was like, oh my god, are they gonna fucking kill him?
Because Joe just after that, he just goes upstairs. I hear somebody say that, I'm turning around. I'll take my chances with the fucking creditors.
Yep. And he's like, what color? Red? And he's like, I don't think red's the right color. Goodbye. one of the lines I was gonna go over, you already said, it's Norma and Desmond. Jesus Christ, Norma and Joe are talking, and Joe says, you're Norma Desmond, you used to be in Silent Pictures, you used to be big. And she says, I am big, it's the pictures that got small. Such a good line.
It is a fantastic line, and kind of reflects, you know, I wonder like how much of that is Billy Wilder kind of reflecting on Hollywood at the time.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
Is it worth throwing away these stars you've cultivated? I don't know. I wonder how many lives were destroyed from, you know, people who thought they'd made it big, and one day they were told, "Eh, you're not famous anymore. We got somebody new, so you can go." Mm-hmm. Like, what do you do with that? You know, I mean, this is a profession that consumes your entire life, and to lose that,
yeah,
it's gonna mess with you. That line and Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
That's a famous line. I didn't realize that was from this.
Both line. Those lines are like iconic from this movie, especially that one, just the implications of everything that's just happened.
Man, yeah, that part. Again, ahead of its time joke here. It's Betty and Joel. Joe. I keep wanting to say Joel. I don't know why. Betty and Joe are sitting, and she says, don't you sometimes hate yourself? And Joe's like, constantly. It's ahead of its time. Yeah.
You're not a writer unless you've got self-loathing and an addiction of some kind.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, I love the opening dialogue when Joe goes to the producer who's got his back and he's pitching this bases loaded story, and Betty walks in and tells him, like, yeah, this was shit. It's like, oh, well, he wrote it, so maybe tell him. She says, perhaps the reason I hated Bases Loaded is that I knew your name. I'd always heard you had some talent. And Joe goes, that was last year. This year I'm trying to earn a living. Like, that's the writer, you know. Half of you wants to stay true to your roots. The other half really needs to pay the rent. And at what point do you lose your integrity, or at least compromise it?
Another one, it's Joe, but as it's his voiceover, he's talking about how Norma at this point has completely lost it. And he says, you don't yell at a sleepwalker. He may fall and break his neck. That's it. She was still sleepwalking along the giddy heights of a lost career. It's so fucking depressing, dude.
I love this one from Joe. He was talking about the last script he wrote. He said, last one I wrote was about Okies in the Dust Bowl. You'd never know, because when it reached the screen, the whole thing played on a torpedo boat. That's what happens, you know? You might turn in the greatest script of your career, but by the time it goes through the studio, the director, the people they hire to rewrite, and the actors, it might be a completely different movie. And that's sad, you know? There's a lot of screenwriters who've disowned a lot of movies that they, you know, they created because it turned into slop.
Yep.
And even in the 50s, you know, that was, you know, you're a screenwriter, you take the chance of, this could be the greatest thing I've ever written. But, you know, after it goes through all these people, this is going to be the movie that destroys my career. Sad.
The last line that I have written down is, it's a line that sums up Norma's character completely. It's when she says, no one leaves a star, makes one a star. And the fact that Norma is completely alone means that she is not a star anymore. People know who she is. Again, I'll talk about my favorite scene in the movie next, but so yeah, depressing.
It is. It's very depressing. This is a downer of a movie. I mean, it's about a man trying to find his place in the world and taking, like, the hope away from another person and then paying for it.
It's also two people at the same stage of their lives at different times. Joe is just now starting his decline. Norma is at the end of her decline. She is, like, finished.
And they meet each other at the same spot on the fucking escalator.
Yep.
It's great.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's good. All right, let's go to scene then. The first scene that's really, like, stood out to me was the monkey funeral, because it is so bizarre and you're not prepared for it. The second he walks into the house and they start talking about a coffin, you're like, you know, is that her fucking ex-husband? Like, what's going on up here? And she's like, I want to bury him in the garden. Is there a law against that? I'm thinking, like, Jesus. And then it's a monkey and you're like, I wasn't expecting that. What kind of world is this? What have we just stepped into?
No.
It's a different movie before he meets Norma.
It really is, yeah. It seemed like just another Billy Wilder movie until that scene.
Yeah, it's like, this is about a dude being chased by, you know, possibly the mob, maybe gonna break his legs or something. And now all of a sudden we're in some weird Alice in Wonderland shit with you know, aging actress and her dead monkey. It's like, what the hell? How did he get here? And yeah, from there, it just gets crazier. And he's immediately fascinated by this situation. And she's just, you know, off-putting as hell from the get-go, because that's who she is.
Yeah. It's like a... I was going to say it's kind of like a Hitchcockian, Lynchian, Scorsese-like movie after the monkey comes in.
Yeah, I believe that. I mean, Hitchcock was, you know, there. So he probably might have wandered on set and been like, nice one, Billy. Like, have you thought about putting a monkey in there? Like, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, Lynch would have a few moments with, like, involving a monkey in his films. I wonder if that came from Sunset Boulevard. I mean, he, you know, Mulholland Drive is another movie about LA and the, you know, named after a street. So I bet this movie was influenced, that was influenced big time by Sunset Boulevard.
The only Lynchian things I've seen is episode one and two of Twin Peaks.
I've seen everything but Inland Empire, because I prepped big time for a Filmgasm special a couple of years ago.
It has like a weird style. There's a video game that I love called Alan Wake that everyone says is Lynchian. Yeah. So I think I like Lynchian, if they are accurate.
I have mixed feelings about David Lynch and his films, because I like structure and things to make sense, and he does not. So, yeah.
I know of a quote he says. Someone says that they were working with him, and he was directing something. I don't remember what he was directing. But someone was like, hey, David, do you think we should like make this scene shorter? And he was like, why the fuck does everyone nowadays want to make things shorter? Why can't it just be the way that it is?
He said something else. This was one of my favorite David Lynch quotes. He said, Eraserhead is my most spiritual film. And the person he was interviewing with said, could you elaborate? And he just said, no. That's awesome. I want that kind of fucking confidence in my work. Just be like, nah.
No.
I said what I said.
Imagine like, hey, Steven, why'd you put the kid gangbang scene in your book? Just because the story needed it. Can you elaborate? No.
That's kind of what he's done every time he's been interviewed about it. He's like, nah, I'm good. I've said enough. Like, no, you can never say enough to justify why you put that in your book, man.
Yeah. I haven't seen Eraserhead.
Eraserhead's fucking bizarre. It's his first movie. It's about a guy who like has a mutant baby and struggles to deal with it. It's his movie about parenthood.
Okay. All right. So my favorite scene in the whole movie is a very powerful scene, in my opinion. It's when Norma gets to Paramount Pictures and she says hello to Hog-Eyed, which you don't have to call yourself Hog-Eyed, man. If you don't like the nickname, don't use it. But it's the whole scene. It's kind of long, but he shines the light on Norma and everyone is like, holy shit, that's Norma Desmond. And everybody like flocks to her and starts like talking to her and like basically worshiping her. And that's the scene where I was like, okay, she is serious. She built Paramount Pictures. And then the director comes in and goes, move that light back to where it belongs. So fucking sad. And that like, that's when I realized that Norma is going crazy, but she's not a bad person. She was literally cast aside and I felt really bad for her.
Yeah, but I think we don't really think about why she was cast aside. I think there's diva behavior in her, there's entitlement, and there's psychosis, clearly.
Mm.
So I don't think it was about her career. I think it was about who she was as a person. I think, and Cecil B. DeMille clearly recognizes that. He recognizes that she's dangerous. And if she gets back in the business, she's going to fuck up a lot of projects. And cool that Cecil B. DeMille played himself. That's always awesome. I love when after all that, like I have that scene written down too, because I love when he's just like, oh, we'll work on something. Like, yeah, of course. I've missed you. Yeah, we got this. And then afterwards, he's like, find that guy. Tell him we don't need the car anymore to stop calling Norma Desmond. Like, just cutting ties right there.
That's not how I took it. Oh, I took it as he felt bad. He was like, I don't want her to realize that I was just using her to get the car. I feel bad. I don't want anything to do this anymore.
See, I took it as I don't want her coming back here. But I got business here. I don't want her distracting anybody or thinking I owe her anything. So stop calling her.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other scene I have written down is the climactic scene where Norma kills Joe.
That's her. That was her breaking point when he says, yep, I'm leaving.
Yep. You don't leave Norma Desmond. Norma Desmond leaves you.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the way he handled that too, was like, he didn't fight. As soon as he got shot, he's like, oh, that's it. And just wandered his way into the pool.
Well, He gets shot first in the back and he keeps walking. I didn't know he got, I thought like she missed. I was like, why are you still walking? He like stumbles a little bit, but I was like, did you get shot? You're still walking. And then she shoots him two more times.
It's also interesting how this movie begins with like Joe dead in the pool. Like we know what's going to happen to him.
So again, because I don't know these actors very well, I didn't realize that that was him talking. I didn't realize the narrator and him. Because also he's also telling the story, so I was like, "Oh, he survived."
Nope.
That's not that cool. Yeah, I know.
That image has been referenced in so many different things. Like, there's an episode of American Dad where like Steve is found dead in the pool of Jell-O after he, like in his mansion, and he's like narrating it.
Did Gatsby pull that from this or?
No, the Gatsby book was written like 30 years before this movie came out. But like, it's an iconic image that has resonated throughout pop culture, which is always cool when you can create something that lasts forever like that, that other people reference. It's always wanted to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's all I've got.
Oh, damn. I have a couple more.
Bring it on. What do you got?
Again, following when she kills Joe, and just her entire psychotic break when she thinks that she's in a movie and she doesn't realize that she's being arrested.
I think it's crazy that the cops feed into that and they go get Cecil B. DeMille to like facilitate this, because they could just drag her out of the mansion. But like, there's a certain level of respect they show her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she just killed a man.
Yeah, but she's like, she's clearly like insane at this point.
Yeah, I mean, people don't stare down their nose when they're.
Ready for my close up. I didn't know that that quote was from this movie. That's what I like about doing. Movies that I've been watching recently, I'm realizing that a lot of pop culture things have come from.
Yeah. They're what I
don't know where they came from.
These films, I call them the building blocks of cinema, because a lot of these references have to start somewhere. A lot of these trends have to start somewhere. And film, you know, directors of this era are the guys who began a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
And once you understand that, you start noticing it in other pictures, and it just continuously influences the conversation. Mm-hmm. And that's the best part of this.
I like Spats Columbo. Didn't realize that was from Some Like It Hot. I thought that was just some stupid fucking gangster name that people said. I didn't realize that was a real character in a real movie.
Yeah. I knew the phrase shut up and deal from The Apartment. I didn't know when I saw The Apartment, like that's what that was from.
Yeah.
So
crazy. Also, cool. There's a Psycho reference in this movie, I think. He says psychopaths sell.
Well, Psycho came out 10 years after Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, but, well, shit. Never mind. That's funny, though.
Yeah. The word psycho did exist before the movie Psycho. Still a cool line. And he's true, you know?
Yeah.
If it bleeds, it leads. That's been a staple of popular culture since the fucking beginning. Yeah. People like juicy shit. They like stories of blood and sex and psychos. It's...
Hence the true crime.
Yep. We've never, that's been the one constant of popular culture since even like the 1800s. Like, we love to hear stories about people dying in gruesome ways.
The Crucible.
Yep. The fucking Bible, man. I mean,
yes.
From the beginning, it's been like, look how horrible, look what God did to these people. It's like, whoa.
Also, just talking about black and white film real quick. I've always heard that Psycho is the first movie that shows a flushing toilet. And anytime I hear that, you know, that fact, I'm like, I don't think I've ever seen another movie with a flushing toilet. Why the fuck would you need to show? Like, I've always like, what's the context? Like, why does it show the flushing
toilet? It is the first movie to show that. And Hitchcock had to fucking fight for that, because the Hays Code was like, how dare you? No, you're never going to show that. And it's not like, you know, Janet Leigh was taking a shit. What happens is She's destroying evidence, and she like tears up a photograph or something and flushes the pieces. So it's letting us know, oh, that's gone.
Yeah, that's no, I know, because I just saw Psycho for the first time, nice. And I was like, I wonder when the toilet's gonna come in. And then she just flushes evidence. And I was like, I don't see how that was a big deal. But I guess, again, for the time.
For 1960, for the Hays, it was very much like, you know, we don't need to go into the bathroom. There's no need for us to ever have to see on camera anything that goes on in there. And Hitchcock was like, you people are crazy. It's my movie.
What was the hazing code?
The Hays code, yeah. It was the motion picture code that was established between the 30s and the early 1960s. Every film that went through Hollywood had to get approval from the Hays office, which basically said, like, these are the rules. The good guy has to win. Crime cannot pay. Crime always pays. No interracial relationships. No homosexual characters. No obvious sexual relationship. Like, it was that's why film was so fucking constricted at that time, and why so many films were conveyor belt fluff.
Hold on. Okay. What was the first one you said?
I don't remember. What did I say? No. What was it? Crime can't pay. Crime has to pay. And then I don't know. Like,
well, in Some Like It Hot. Wait, no, not Some Like It Hot. In The Apartment, they're obviously having sex.
Yeah, but that was 1960. It was almost gone. Yeah, this was mostly in like between the 30s to the late 50s was when this was enforced.
Gotcha.
And it's fucking ridiculous because it's very much like it makes everything predictable.
Yeah.
It's like now I know the bad guy's going to lose. It's like, yeah, because they have to.
Yeah, the bad guy loses. I don't think in this movie the bad guy loses. Well, yes, he does. Sorry, Joe's the bad guy.
Well, whoever the bad guy is, like, he's dead and she goes to jail. So.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. Whichever way you slice it, the bad guy loses.
And but there's, yeah, isn't there a Psycho 2 and 3?
And 4.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't seen them. I've heard they're actually not bad.
Interesting. I wonder how they can continue.
Norman Bates in part 2 gets like released from psychiatric care because he's cured and he struggles to actually be cured. But, you know, mother keeps coming back into his head and telling him, you know, Norman, like you gotta kill Norman. Like, so that's Psycho 2, I guess. I haven't seen it yet, but that's what I've heard.
Have you seen the show?
I watched the pilot. I couldn't get into it, but that was years ago. So maybe it deserves another shot. I mean, I don't know how you make a series out of like weird kid and his weird mom.
Yeah.
Like, it's not Psycho till like the last season.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe no, it was critically acclaimed. Maybe I'm in the wrong here. I did see the remake in 1998 and that was horseshit.
Oh, with Vince Vaughn?
Oh yeah.
Well, yeah, it's Vince Vaughn.
It's shot for shot. It's the same exact script. It's the same exact camera angles. It's everything is exactly the same.
Really?
Yeah. It's ridiculous. There's no point in this movie at all. Like, they didn't do anything different. Not even the framing. Like, nothing. It's awful.
But Vince Vaughn, that's such a shitty casting.
Yeah. And you know what? He's not intimidating.
No. Like, he's Vince Vaughn.
Yeah.
Vince Vaughn is the used car salesman of Hollywood. He's the talker.
That's awesome. I love that. Well, let's take a look at what Letterboxd has to say about this movie on our final segment, What's in the Box?
What's in the fucking box?
Sunset Boulevard rocking 4.4 out of 5. That is amazing.
That's good.
So 4 out of 5 for me, total, like, easy, yeah, 4 out of 5.
Absolutely.
But I have some people here who disagreed. I have 3 negative ones and 2 positive ones.
Okay.
This first one just pissed me off so much. This is from Ozu 1999. It's like slow and old, 0.5 star. This okay. movie is anything but slow. This is an yeah. electric, very well-paced movie. An old, fuck you. Why are you here?
Yeah.
Ugh. This next one's from Begrenzung. Not for me. Norma is depicted without humanity. She is a living, breathing cartoon villain. Everything Wilder touches is so overcooked and hammy. 1 star. What are you talking about? Like, I think she gets quite a fair shake in this movie with an attempt to make her seem human.
Yeah.
Wilder knew what he was doing. Overcooked, my ass.
Yeah. That's bullshit.
Yeah. This one's from Bennings. Calling a classic boring always makes me feel like I failed as a human, but fucking hell, this movie was boring. It's also simply not funny on any level. 1 star.
I don't think it's supposed to be funny. I think it's like a pseudo horror movie.
Yeah, it's not supposed to be fun. But I would love if like that was his caveat for every movie he ever watched. Like, this isn't even funny. 1 star. It's just everything. Fucking Schindler's List. I didn't laugh one time. 1 star. Jesus. But that first part, I do agree with that. Whenever I don't like a classic, I always feel like the asshole.
Yeah.
It's hard to get past that. It's hard to, like, you know, fight against the grain like that. But I think, you know, everyone's taste is different. And you just got to, you know, accept what, if you don't like it, you don't like it. That's it.
I mean, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, sometimes you're wrong. Like in this case, you are wrong, Bennings. But, you know, there's been classics I didn't like, and I tried to, you know, defend my decision in my reviews and in my podcasts. And I think I accomplished that.
Yeah.
And now for the positive ones. This one's from Aaliyah. First mistake was trusting a Sagittarius. 4.5 stars.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, that's what starts it. As soon as she finds out he's a Sagittarius, she's like, I love Sagittarius. You want to stay here forever?
Yes.
Oh, and this one's from Punk with a Q. It's like the entire history of Hollywood up to that point coming together for one psychotic climax. 5 stars.
Yeah. Beautiful. I agree with that. I have a Google review, and this review is the reason I asked if they ever did a remake, because this review is confusing.
Okay.
This is by Neil Simpson. He gave it 1 star. It says, can someone please explain, A, why did they decide to turn this classic show and film into a comedy? B, why would you cast someone so young in the lead role? And C, what happens to the wonderful, pathetic character that Gloria Swanson and Glenn Close portrayed? It was awful.
Glenn Close? Let me do some research here.
I don't understand.
Sunset Boulevard remake. Oh, okay. So they did this on the stage with Glenn Close. They did a West End revival in London on the stage with Glenn Close as Norma Desmond. So this guy's bitching about the stage production remake, I guess. That's weird.
It's weird.
And Glenn Close, like, if I had to remake this today, she would 100% be the person I would cast as Norma Desmond.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's great casting.
I know.
She's still big. It's only the pictures that got small.
Yeah, it's only the pictures.
Yeah, this was a blast. I'm looking forward to this miniseries. This was a great way to start this out.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if I should announce what we're doing next, or we should keep it a secret in case we got to shift shit around. I think we'll keep it a secret. Just trust us. Next week's going to be fucking funny.
Yes. I'm excited for next week.
This was a blast. Thanks for listening, everybody. If you like the show, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Filmgasm Productions. If you want to suggest films for us to check out, you can email us at filmgasm@gmail.com or send us a message through the socials. Check out our Letterboxd accounts for daily reviews. You search for me at Connor95, and in my friends list, you can find the rest of the team. Check out the website, filmgasm.com, where I have a link to that letterbox. You can also find articles, trailers of upcoming films, and every episode of our show. If you'd like to become a monthly donor to Filmgasm Productions, click on the link in the episode description. From there, click on Support This Podcast, You can choose to donate $1 a month, $5 a month, or $10 a month, and all donations go right back into the show. Thanks to the entire Filmgasm team for their contributions. Thanks to Cooley Cow for our awesome theme music. Thanks to you for checking it out. We'll have another Reelgasm for you soon. In the meantime, remember that fame has its psychological price. Take it easy, keep watching movies, and we'll see you next time. The best,